please help welcome our speaker tonight. It is Tim from the Great Fat Group of Why I'm Missing, PA.
I'm an alcoholic. My name's Tim. I didn't drink all day. And it makes it a nice day. Yeah. I try to remember to introduce myself that way because that is still important. You know, it's the first thing I got to get done every day is to make that decision. I was visiting out at a meeting in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, and it was a daytime meeting, and it was they must have just brought the bus in from the local senior citizens. Everybody's adjusting their hearing aids, and it was one of those meetings that you go, you know, you have to share in order, and I don't really care for that, you know, where you're sitting in a circle and it's your turn to share because the guy next to you just finished, you know. I have a hard time listening to that guy, right? You know why? Because I'm rehearsing what I'm going to say, you know. But I made the comment that that morning I got down on my knees, right, and I made the most important decision I ever made in my entire life. I made the decision not to drink, and I asked God to keep me away from a drink all day. You know? And I've been doing this for 25 years, you know, and it's worked every day that I've done that, you know. But apparently that's all they heard because four guys came up and offered to sponsor me, you know. And guess what? You know, I took all of their numbers and I called each and every one of them. That's how the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous helps guys with time and guys without time. You know? I was born and raised in North Jersey. I'm the youngest of seven children. My dad ran away from home when I was an infant. And, you know, my brother Larry used to joke, Timmy was such a bad baby, the old man ran away from home, you know. The fact of the matter is, right, when presented with a choice, right, between being with his family and having a drink, he always made the decision to be with his family. But then he went and had a drink. And it wasn't until I got sober that I realized, you know, he was powerless over that. I come from a long line of alcoholics, a long line of dead alcoholics. So alcoholism was rampant in my family, right? And my mother had no problem, you know, letting us know all along, age appropriately, you know, that the reason my dad wasn't around was because he was an alcoholic, you know. And again, after I got sober, more of this stuff started to come, you know, I started to understand. And, you know, I remember, even though my dad was an alcoholic, right, her brother, Bill, right, never missed a day of work, right? And her brother, Ward, was a pain in the butt. And her brother Buddy had seven daughters that he had to support. And her brother Lawrence was the life of the party. The fact of the matter is, right? Oh, and her father, right, used to go down to the corner and sing the old Irish songs for the poor immigrant boys who were homesick. You know, they were all drunks. You know, all drunks. And, you know, so there was the acknowledgement on the one hand, but huge denial on the other. You know? When I got sober, right, and my sponsor helped me pick the three specific things that I was going to sit down and talk to my mom about when I was doing my night step work, you know, we have this conversation. You know, and I was afraid that two of the ones that we picked, she didn't really know about, you know, she knew everything, you know, I get to the part where, you know, okay, now what, you know, what is it that I can do today and going forward, right, to amend for that past behavior? And we talked about, you know, she didn't let me off the hook for sure. And, you know, at the end of the conversation, she said, Timmy, I'm just glad you nipped this thing in the bud. You know, Ma, if I nipped this thing in the bud, we wouldn't be having this conversation. I would have gotten drunk twice as a teenager. I would have gotten, you know, I would have drank twice and puked three times. You know, you're not an alcoholic, you know. But you know, in spite of all the evidence, the denial was still there. Art, my story tonight should disclose in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. What I was like was I was an outgoing person who was not letting you in. All right. I was friendly as a defense so that you wouldn't get to know me. And you know, I mean, growing up without a dad was fairly unusual in the time and place where I grew up. Back, you know, in fact, in elementary school, I was the only kid in my class, right, who didn't have both parents in the home. You know, it was a blue collar town, but I was the only kid in the class who didn't have two parents at home. At the time, right, we didn't call it, but you know, that type of home was referred to as a broken home. You know, something's not right. You know, I've had the opportunity in Alcoholics Anonymous to sponsor guys and make friends, right, with all sorts of people who grew up in homes with both parents. And those homes were so much more broken, you know, than the one I came from. You don't need to have, you know, divorce and separation to break up a family. The disease of alcoholism can do all kinds of damage in all kinds of ways. But I mean, you know, I had a pretty good time as a kid. I enjoyed myself quite a bit. I have an older brother. My brother Patrick is 6 years older than me, and he got sober 3 years before I did. And we were at a thing, and a buddy of his mentioned to him, because my sister was whining and complaining, he says, "Geez, Pat, I didn't know you guys grew up so poor." You know, and Pat said, "Yeah, me neither. I was too busy having fun. You know, we were just kids. You know, but it's funny what our perceptions, as you know, we've become adults and gotten sober. How different each sibling's perception is. You know, of you know what it was like. But I had a lot of fun, and then I had even more fun when I got to high school. That was because I got too weird. So I went to an all-boys Catholic school, right, in North Arlington, New Jersey, called Queen of Peace Boys High School. And it was on the second floor of a building, the first floor of which housed Queen of Peace Girls High School. Like, what? So the nuns got sick of the boys in the early 1960s, and they brought in the Christian Brothers from Ireland, and they separated the boys and the girls. That was actually kind of cool because, you know, I could just be a regular guy most of the day, and I didn't have to, you know, put on the show to impress the women I wanted to impress, the girls, right, for only, you know, lunchtime and a couple of other things, you know, and then some of the extracurricular activities. All of which, for me, involved drinking. I have a sister, Madonna, who's 1 year older than me. And at the end of my freshman year, which was the end of her sophomore year, she asked me to explain to her how it was that the president of the chess club, the president of the physics club, right, two of the football players, a couple of the cheerleaders, the kid that was the Jethro Tull impersonator, the guys that were in choir and in the theater group, you know, how was it that I had such a diverse group of friends? You know? And I said, just lucky, I guess, you know. I didn't know it then, right? We all had something in common, you know. They all drank the same way I did at age 14 and 15, you know. So I was talking to Donna before the meeting, and I knocked on wood. I haven't gotten a DUI yet. In some ways, I think that helped me because based on my personality, if I had been punished for my drinking, right, I think, you know, my Irish arrogance and ignorance and denial, right, would have kicked in might have prevented me from asking for help when I knew I was ready. But I had a good time in high school. I had such a good time in high school that as the youngest, other than my sister who's mentally retarded, I didn't go straight to college when I got out of high school, you know. And I had decided I was going to do some traveling. I wanted to see a little bit of, you know, something beyond Belleville and Jersey City, New Jersey. So over the next 2.5 years, I worked loading trucks, and I traveled to places like Hoboken, Asbury Park, and Seaside. I remember my sister Kathleen only a few years ago being surprised that I didn't know something about the beach regulations at Seaside. And she said, you used to go to Seaside all the time. And I said to her, but I've never actually been on the beach, you know. During that time period, I met the gal who is now my wife. And I decided to go to college. I paid my way through Rutgers in Newark. I went there for 4 years. I excelled for a period of time while I was there, and then discovered a place called McGovern's 2 blocks from the campus. And in my senior year, never finished a 6-credit honors project. And I kept telling myself, I'll go next semester and figure out what we have to do, you know. And this is not something I'm proud of, but I frequently mention it when I'm telling my story, because it's really, and again, retrospect, man, you know. It was the first big thing that my alcoholism took from me, you know. I didn't know it at the time. My buddy Greg used to say, damn, Tim, just get your receipt, you know. Because I had done all that work, but when I was presented, right, with the opportunity to finish something very important to me that I had started, right, when I proceeded to do that, I stopped off for a quick drink on my way to do that. Junior year of high school, Tracy Mullaney, the girl I was dating at the time, she was a year behind me, so she was a sophomore, and she comes home one day, she comes out one day, and we're going to walk home, and she's got this questionnaire from health class, and it was, you know, the 20 questions, you know, about your drinking, and she's asking me these questions, and by the time we get to the third question, I'm telling lies, you know. And I said, you know, is this new? I don't remember having this last year, you know. And, again, retrospect, right, a couple of years later, and drinking age was 18 in New Jersey at the time. A couple of years later, I ran into, and I don't know what it's like in public schools, but at Catholic schools, you wear many hats. So the baseball coach was also the health teacher, you know. He was also my driver's ed teacher, right? So I ran into him at a bar, right? He kept up with me, you know. Retrospect, you know, he probably skipped that module, you know, when it was time to go over, because, you know, didn't want to look at it. I haven't gotten a DUI yet. I haven't abandoned my family yet. I haven't beat my wife or my children yet. I haven't been fired for drinking on the job yet. It got worse. I was told when I was new in AA, I got sober in the Poconos, and at 30 days you had to, at 90 days you got a little pin for your lapel. We didn't have chips, and you had to tell your story, and you had to make a date with your sponsor to show him your written fourth step to do the fifth step. You know, and the advice I was given about the first time I was going to speak was, try not to rehearse in your mind ahead of time. If you hear yourself, or if you feel like you're rehearsing, ooh, I got to remember to, you know, say a quick prayer. God, don't let me rehearse. You know, and if you lose your train of thought, just say it got worse. No matter where you are in your story, it'll always be true. It got worse. I still work in the same industry. I've been employed in the same industry. I'm not working right now. That I was at the end of my drinking, and it's changed. We're now dressed more like Tom, but at the time, jacket and tie, and quite frankly, suits, right, was the norm. Right? And at the end of my drinking, you know, I, if you just looked at me from the neck down, I looked fine, right? And I remember asking one of the barmaids at the American Legion, you know, no, Doug, right? Yeah, I didn't serve in the armed forces, VFW and American Legion, and they have what's called a social member. Do you know what a social member is? A heavy drinker who wants to buy cheap. You know, sign me up. So I joined the American Legion, and I remember asking Pat, the gal who was the barmaid, what was it that made her, how did she pick exactly when she was either going to say no more shots, right, and take away my shot glass, or go home, you know? And she said, you know, Timmy, she said, with you, it's like a light switch goes off, you know, and your eyes just change. And it's just, you know, it's that boom. And retrospect, right? I'm just ready to go into a blackout. You know, I'm starting in that brown out, you know. I thought blackout was normal, right? I did not know that everybody did not have blackouts. So at the end of my drinking, I would promise, right, my wife, that I would be home by 5:30 or 6, right? No later than 7, right? And I'm going to stop for 1, maybe 2. And of course, I didn't get home till 1 a.m., right? And you know why that is, right? Because the VFW closes at 12:30, right? But now I meant that when I said, right, 1, maybe 2. And, there were times I would get cut off early, you know, 9 or 10 o'clock, right? And I was convinced that if I drove fast enough, I could get home on time. I was also convinced that if I walked in the door and went right to the bathroom to pee, that would be proof, right, that I'd been drinking. And so I would stand at the side of the road, dressed like I'm dressed now, and take care of that ahead of time. And because a trooper pulled over once when I was doing that, you know, I stopped unzipping. And it made sense to me. You know, it made sense to pee my pants. That's how much I wanted to prove that I didn't have a drinking problem. At the end of my drinking, I still had my job. I still had it was a 2-year-old Ford Tempo. I bought it brand new. I paid $10,123 for it. And in the first 14 months that I owned it, my insurance company paid another $18,000 in $3,000 chunks fixing it, you know. I had a $28,000 Ford Tempo, you know, almost enough money to buy three of them. I was at a luncheonette in town having lunch, and I went to go pay, and had seen the guys from the body shop, you know, kind of a wave hello, and I went to go pay, and the cashier said, "Oh no, Frank took care of that." I said, "Frank?" She said, "Yeah, Frank from Auto Body Technicians." You know, and I thought, that's weird, you know. And I stopped there because it's only a couple blocks away. I said, "Hey, why'd you buy me lunch?" She said, "You kidding me?" She said, "You buy me steak for 5 years, you know." But anyway, I still had my job. I still had my car. I still had my wife and my children. And I didn't want any of it, you know. I just wanted to be left alone. And I just wanted to drink. When I was 19 years old, I tracked down my dad. My brother Larry and I tracked him down. When he left the home, he left us in a nice 6-bedroom home with the 7 kids, you know. He was the district sales manager for Sylvania. And, you know, a new car every 2 years that belonged to the company. You know, he was fairly successful. When I found him 19 years later, 18 and a half years later, he had worked his way up to, right, a free studio apartment in the basement of a high-rise apartment building in Elizabeth, New Jersey, the Alexian Brothers Senior Citizen Housing Complex. And he got a free apartment because he had gotten his Black Seal license, which means he knew how to check the furnace to make sure the heat was working right, you know. And when we tracked him down and got to meet with him, he was in this tiny little studio, and he was surrounded by piles and piles of paperback books, you know, and a 55-gallon drum size garbage can, you know. And what was fairly unusual in those days, one of those little, you know, now they call it a dorm refrigerator, you know. And at the end of my drinking, that was appealing to me, you know, because it was obvious that on the one hand, you know, it kind of felt a little good that, you know, we made this effort and reached out. On the other hand, based on some follow-up conversations, he really just wanted to be left alone, you know. That was appealing to me at the end of my drinking. So 6 months before I had my last drink, I had heard enough bits and pieces from my brother. And so I knew that, you know, the whole not drinking thing was just a one day at a time thing. And I got up in the morning and got ready for work, and I remember shaving in the mirror, and I remember looking in the mirror and saying, "Today is the day, Timmy, you know, I'm not going to drink today," you know, and I felt pretty good about it, you know, and I felt pretty confident, you know, because there had been other times with other problems, right, that I'd been able to set my mind to it, you know, and take care of it. And I remember, you know, that was one of the things growing up, my mom always said, you can do anything you put your mind to, you know. And, you know, round about, 5 o'clock that afternoon, right, I realized, right, that the stupidest day of the week to quit drinking is Tuesday, and it's a Tuesday, you know. So I said, okay, we're going to postpone this, you know. And again, retrospect, right, I thought I changed my mind, right. I was just powerless over alcohol because every day up until that point, right, you know, when I left my house in the morning, I was working, you know, and I went to see a customer. And then from there, I went to another one. And then, it, you know, boom, 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 boom. And all day long, right, I'm working out in my mind, where am I going to have my first drink, you know. And so all day that Tuesday, right, every time that thought popped into my mind, because that's what I'm used to thinking, oh, that's right, I'm not going to drink today, you know. And so by 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I was crazy. And then, ta-da, I realized that Tuesday is the stupidest day to quit drinking. And so, boy, it was a horror story that night for me, you know. And then like halfway, I was like, you know what? I didn't need to do this. I could, you know, I'm drunk by now, and I'm thinking to myself, I could have not drank today, you know. I didn't have to drink, you know. Ah, this was stupid, you know. And so, you know, not every day, but I was doing that a lot, you know. And it got to the point, you know, by the end of my drinking, I was walking into hotel bars at 11 a.m., you know. There were one or two other guys at the bar, you know, dressed like me, way older than me, looking like I was going to look if I didn't stop soon, you know. And I'd be a big shot and throw the credit card and say, give everybody in the bar a drink. And then I finally called my brother Pat, and he took me to my first meeting. May 10th, 1992, I joined the Kirkridge Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. On May 11th, I drank the last bit of beer that was in the house and a bunch of Jameson's. And so May 12th, 1992 is my sobriety date. It got worse. Not drinking and driving around all day with all this free time, you know. And there were no cell phones to call people, you know. If I wanted to call somebody, I had to, you know, stop the car, get out and find a payphone, a whole routine, you know. So what I did, right, was, and I don't see them here. You see, sometimes you see the slogans. So what I did all day was think. You know, think, you know. And you know, Richie became my sponsor, and you know, don't think, don't drink, you know. And I mean all I could do was think, you know. And I'd call him sometimes and I'd be, and he'd say, it sounds like you're thinking, you know. Yeah, okay, you know. But don't think, you know. And, you know, when I finally realized what that meant, I said, I got to think about this, you know. And so I was given cassette tapes with speakers. I was given cassette tapes with stories being read by some stories from the Grapevine magazine being read out loud on these tapes, you know. And they would put together, you know, a dozen stories all kind of on the same theme, you know. I didn't know it at the time, but the guys I was going to meetings with, right, they were taking my inventory, right, because they would be giving me these tapes that had themes, you know, anger, you know, spirituality, denial, honesty, you know, and thank God for those. Thank God for those. I was told, right, now my brother was living in North Jersey at the time, and the style of AA meetings were very similar. I was told to go to as many meetings per week as the number of days that you drank per week. And whatever my facial expression said, Richie said to me, this is not hard math. The highest number is 7, you know, because I'm going, So I went to a meeting every day, and what they used to say was, if you go to a meeting every day for 90 days, right, you will have heard enough about alcoholism to figure out on your own whether or not you're one of us. And you decide that you're an alcoholic. And Richie said, I can't tell you that you're an alcoholic. You decide that. And I remember, and of course the joke always was, and if you decide you're not an alcoholic, that's great, We will gladly refund your misery, But I remember, now again, I'm a friendly guy as a defense, so you don't get to know me, right? And hopefully I'm still a friendly guy, and hopefully I've gotten better at opening up my heart, I remember being very careful not to tell people, too much, about me. And, there was this, take the cotton out of your ears, thing and just listen. At about, 65, 70 days, whatever, it was, getting close to that thing. I realized, aha, eureka. I am not an alcoholic, So after the meeting, I said to Richie, I made a commitment to do this thing for 90 days, and we're getting up to the end, but I'm pretty sure, that I'm not an alcoholic. And he said, okay, I heard you say that you're going to follow through on your commitment, right? You're going to finish the 90. I go, yeah, and I'll probably get my pin too, and he said, okay, and I said, but I'm pretty sure, he said, well, you might hear something over the next couple of weeks, I said, yeah, it's getting a little repetitive, I think I've probably heard everything I need to hear, and I'm pretty sure I'm not an alcoholic. And then he proceeded to tell me five things that I had told him. Things that had happened to me, things that I had done, and I'm like, I never told you that, have you? And the last one was, having my pants cut off me in the ER, coming out of a blackout or passed out, whatever, and my pants are being scissored off me, And he said, in light of that, those five things, Timmy, if you're not an alcoholic, let me ask you this. What is wrong with you? Dude, what is your problem? Think. Think. So I am an alcoholic. I was talking to the guy who was my sponsor for the majority of the time that I was in the Poconos earlier today. And at a year and a half sober, I changed sponsors. My first sponsor, Richie, had me do a written four step out of a guidebook that he had gotten. And then my fifth step, and we did it after a meeting one night, and we set it on fire in the parking lot per his instructions. And as it was burning up, right, he said to me, Timmy, you don't ever have to be that man again. And I just felt a sense of relief, And it hasn't happened lately, but there have been times in my sobriety, right, when that memory comes back, and that feeling comes back, And it's usually because I'm acting like that man again, I'm going, Richie used to say, you're either going towards a drink or away from a drink, And you can control that behavior. You can control those thoughts, and if you can't, you can ask for help. My sister-in-law gave me the key to this whole deal on the way to my first meeting when she said, Timmy, the thing is, none of us could do this alone. And I didn't really know what that meant, but I got a little sense of comfort from that. you know. And early on, right, it was, for me, it meant none of us could do this. I couldn't do this without you guys, you know. And then as time wore on and I was able to build a relationship with my higher power, who chooses to call himself God, I say today, I can't do this without God, you know. And luckily for me, God speaks directly to me through your mouths in church basements, and I'm grateful for that. Those first two sponsors were both named Richie, and they used to tease me about, you know, I didn't like chains, so I had to pick another guy, you know, with the same name. Richie number one, he used to make me read the book, right, with a dictionary. I remember him saying to me, "You think you're so smart, you know." And what I thought he said was, "You're a smart guy, Timmy, you know." You know, but he made me read the book with a dictionary. And even though I knew the words, he would make me look up certain words. You know, in spite of being so quote unquote smart, it was almost 2 months before I realized that Richie lived across the street from me. So he had Subaru made a two-seater sports car that was kind of like a TR7. It was like triangular, flat back and a pointy nose. They made like 10 of them, you know, and his was puke green. How could I not notice it? You know, and the way I figured it out was because we ended up leaving a meeting together. I knew he lived in the same development I was in. We ended up leaving a meeting together one night, and he was right in front of me. And as we're going up the mountain, I'm thinking, when's he going to turn off? When's he going to turn off? You know, because I was at the very top. Boom, one more house and the road starts heading back. You know, and just as we get to my house, he puts on his left blinker and he pulls into this driveway. And I stopped the car and I rolled down the window. I go, "What are you doing here?" He says, "Going home and going to bed, jackass." Sorry. So Mocus, right? I also didn't know, right, that Richie had gotten sober in Narcotics Anonymous in New York, right? And that was why he never took me through the big book, because he hadn't done it. That's why he had given me this guidebook, right? And that's why he dragged me to a 12 and 12 group, you know? And, you know, he had me read, and my brother told me years later, you know, God bless him for, you know, minding his own business. You know, he thought it was strange, you know, that my sponsor had me reading, you know, steps 1, 2, and 3, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, you know, boom, 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 every day, round robin, the 1, 2, 3 waltz out of the 12 and 12, you know, at 10 minutes sober, you know. But that's what Richie knew, right? And that's, you know, and guess what, you know? I think the most important thing he did was get me to do that that written four step, you know, and do that fifth step. And it removed any fear I might have had, you know. So Richie number two was a guy that had gotten sober using the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And my home group, right, is it's a big book. It's a closed big book meeting. And it's called the Great Fact Group. And it comes from page 25. I'm going to pull this out. Thank you, Lauren. It comes from page 25 in the chapter, There is a Solution. You know, I had talked about, you know, we had lost the power of choice in drink, and Bowen says, you know, okay, there is a solution. And the next paragraph says this, right? The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences, asterisk, footnote, fully explained appendix 2, right? That we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. And it was interesting the way that came out, or came to be chosen as the name of our group from that passage. You know, I remember at like 5 years sober thinking, If I had known I was going to change this much, I'd have been scared right out of here, you know. And then at 10 years sober, thinking, yeah, I wouldn't have believed it was possible. You know, I thought the coffee makers at my home group were smoking pot. And here's why, right? Sunday night, it was about 200 people for this speaker meeting. We used urns, but we made them in coffee makers in the kitchen. We were we met at one of the resorts in Shawnee on Delaware, right on the river there in the Poconos. But anyway, you had to go back. You know, they're constantly back and forth to the kitchen with these pots, and they were filling the big urns. You know, and it seemed to me every time they came out of the kitchen, they were laughing and giggling and having a good time. You know, and it seemed like when you looked around the room, they were the people who were having the most fun. You know. So I just assumed, because I got close enough to do the old sniff test on these suckers, you know. And Richie introduced me to a bunch of folks who read the book and studied the book. I heard somebody announce Big Book Comes Alive. That's what, you know, Joe and Charlie's original study of the book was called. And there was a guy... I think he really just memorized Joe and Charlie's tapes, you know, and he walked a bunch of us through it. And it was exactly what I needed when I needed, you know, at a year and a half sober. And they told me that if I wanted to ensure, right, ongoing sobriety, I needed to work with other guys. And I really wasn't all that interested in working with other guys. I was, right, willing to follow direction. So against my better judgment, you know, and I remember telling Rishi number one, you know, yeah, I don't think this is going to work, but I'm going to do it so I can say, aha, you know, haven't gotten to say that, you know. I've been blessed with the opportunity, really, since just before I got my 2-year coin. I've been blessed with the opportunity to sponsor men, you know, and I've been able to stay sober through the process. In fact, I have a 100% success rate as a sponsor, and by that I mean I have not had a drink since I started sponsoring guys. You know? And again, you know, it's important for me to be able to say I didn't drink all day. You know? The guy who took us through that book, we had a really cool nickname for him, but I don't share that with you today because I found out, right, that he's struggling. You know, that knowledge wasn't enough for him. You know? I don't know why. You know. I've been able to hang on to the gift, other than a tiny little bit of willingness, you know, to keep taking suggestions. Two things. When I got sober in 1992, I'd never heard the promises read in a meeting, you know. I've been to places now where you see them hanging on the wall and they're numbered, you know. I like the promises because I think that they're powerful and they give us a something to hope for, something to strive for. You know, there's 7.5 pages of instructions, right, about how to fit ourselves to be of maximum use to God, right? And they're the instructions on how to do the ninth step, right? And then after 7.5 pages of instructions, the next line says, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, okay, we will be amazed before we are halfway through making amends to all these people. I'm adding that, you know, but that's what that is, you know. These promises come true as we do the work. But Richie number two used to point out that there's a promise on every single page. And I got to participate once in a workshop that was called A Promise on Every Page. Some of these promises are not happy promises. Some of them are not positive promises. And the one that's not positive, right, is the one that I have to watch all the time, right, and have consistently over the years, and that's resentment, you know. It's not, I am not, it's not a good idea for me to have a job where I have time to think all, you know, I have these, you know, half hour, 45 minute increments to think, you know. Thank God for cell phones now. If I catch myself thinking, I can pick up the phone, you know. But as my buddy Sheldon from Las Vegas says, you know, I don't sit on the couch on Saturday afternoon and start spiraling upward about all the wonderful things in my life, you know. I sit on the couch Saturday afternoon, and in 20 minutes I'm thinking just how much, you know, everything's not great. And I'm going to share with you why Richie was a genius when he said to me, use a dictionary when you read this book. And why Richie number two is a genius when he said, you're going to have to go through this with, have somebody walk you through it. And he's talking about resentments, right? This business of resentment is infinitely grave. You know, we found that it's fatal. For when harboring such feelings, right? And to harbor to me means to hold close and protect. And I do that with my resentments. You know, I hold them close, you know. We shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit, capital S, right? So I block myself off from God, right? The insanity of alcohol returns, right? Which is a drink will make it better, right? That's the insanity, right? And we drink again. And with us, to drink is to die, you know. And I can tell you that I know lots of people who drank again, and they did not. We didn't have a funeral for them, but they sure died. You know, the father they became, the mother they became, the sibling, the son, the daughter, the parent. That was all gone. You know, they were unable to do the gifts, do the things that sobriety enabled them to do. For me, a big part of sobriety, the gift of sobriety, the reasons for sobriety, the benefit that means the most to Tim is, you know, and I always tell the guys I sponsor, I have a positive prejudice to help families heal. You know, having grown up without my dad, you know, and so, you know, we talk about, you hear people talk about, you know, dysfunctional families, and you hear people talk about, you know, they're told, oh, you know, we don't talk about this outside of the house, you know, we keep our, but you don't hang out your dirty laundry, you know, we keep our business in the house, you know. I can tell you from my own experience, right, as a family member, right, in the family I grew up in, and working with guys, sponsoring guys, right? It's the problem isn't that we don't talk about our stuff outside the house. We don't talk about our stuff inside the house. You know? And so my girls were not quite four, and Megan was 3 and a half, and Caitlin was 16 months old, you know? You know, one, you know, kind of like my life slogan has become, we can't help each other unless we tell each other the truth. And so I have always tried to tell my daughters the truth, you know, the truth about my alcoholism, age appropriately. You know, I think it's like third grade they started with DARE, and we're sitting at the dinner table, and Caitlin tells me that she, you know, they're doing the DARE, and they're talking, you know, we'd always talk about what was going on, and she told the teacher that her dad was an alcoholic, you know, and I was okay with that, and I said, that's good, and she said to me, but the teacher said you're not really an alcoholic. I said, oh, really, why is that? You know? Well, when I told her, she asked me, do you drink every day? And I said, no, you don't drink at all. And she said, don't worry, honey, he's not an alcoholic, you know. Here's the lady teaching the DARE, you know. But, you know, so I... It got worse. Okay, quick benefit on sponsorship. You can't make this stuff up, you know. The gifts I've gotten from working with other guys, you know, the smiles, the laughter, the love, right? We do this thing, who and why, you know, because we've all made the mistake of going ahead and doing a ninth step without having a conversation with our sponsor, quote unquote, 5 minutes before or a day ahead in prep, you know. Yeah, we kind of went over that when we were doing that, you know, fourth and fifth. Oh, and by the way, thanks a lot, Richie. You know, I could have used those papers that were burning up in the parking lot when it came time for step eight, you know. So I'll get a phone call, you know, hey, I'm going to go, you know, I have an opportunity, blah, blah, blah. Okay, who is it and what was it, you know? And I have permission to tell this story without revealing. And he said, you know, it was that guy from high school who stole my trick yo-yo. And I said, okay. And he said, yeah, he says, I'm not sure. Somehow you twisted that around that I have to make amends to that guy. You know, I twisted it around, you know, and then there's this pause and he says, oh, yeah, I shot him twice with my BB gun, you know. And so, you know, if you're paying attention, you can have some fun. But having the opportunity to be a dad, right? To learn from you folks how to be a dad, right? Because I had no example growing up, right? Has always been a big part of, you know. And so I remember at the very end of my drinking, it was during that 6 months when I was trying to quit on my own, where my daughter Megan, you know, she was still at that age at 3 and a half where she'd come running, you know, whether it was grandma, grandpa, daddy coming home from work, whatever, she'd come running, jump in your arms, give you a kiss. And I remember scooping her up and I barely giving her a hug and she wiggles right out and she runs down the hall. She says, I'll get daddy's beer, you know? And I was like, ooh. And I'm like trying to make sure my peripheral doesn't work because I don't want my wife and I to acknowledge what just happened, you know? And thank God, you know, I know now that what happened was she knew two very important things about dad, you know? The one, unfortunately, was when I walk in a door, I'm getting a beer. The other one, thankfully, was that, you know, I wanted a hug first. So my daughter, Caitlin, and neither one of them really remember my drinking, but at 16 months old. So at 10 years of sobriety, my daughter, Caitlin, is sitting across from me at Osgood's, where there's like 18 people from the Friday night AA and Al-Anon meeting. And somebody said something, and I said, yeah, ask my sponsor. And Caitlin says, you have a sponsor, Dad? I go, well, yeah, everybody in AA has a sponsor. She says, you're in AA? I go, well, yeah, what'd you think? She said, well, I know you talk to guys late at night when they're upset, and I know you give guys rides, and I know you give... make coffee, but I didn't know you were in. I thought that was just like, you know, service work, you know. And, you know, I said, okay, that's okay, you know. So then a couple minutes goes by, and she looks up and she goes, do you have stories, you know? And her eyes are like, and so 10 years later, she came to an anniversary in New Jersey where I was speaking. And at some point during my story, I got a little teared up and I didn't have a handkerchief with me. And, somebody in the front got up, walked in the back, pulled two paper towels off the roll in the kitchen, comes walking up the center aisle, hands it to me. Everybody got a chuckle. I wiped the tears in my eyes. And as I'm telling my story that night, every time I glance over at my daughter, now this is a highly edited, right, version. She's like this. And, you know, just with those big saucer eyes. And... So real quick, so that when that night when I was getting my pants cut off me, right, It was 3 a.m. Christmas Eve, right? And as I come out of this blackout, right, my wife is standing there at the end of the gurney with my six-month-old daughter, you know, on her hip, you know. That's what my alcoholism took me to, one of the places. And I'm getting to the end of my story, and for some reason I was crying a lot that night, and all of a sudden this guy gets up and he goes back to the kitchen. He grabs two more paper towels, and I still got, well, like, you know, a square inch left that's still dry, you know. And he comes walking up the aisle and stops at the second row and leans in and hands them to my daughter. And the tears, she's just sitting there quietly, and the tears are streaming down her face. And on the ride home, I said, "You learned a lot about your dad tonight." And she said, "Daddy, I had no idea you were that broken." She said, "AA took a broken man and gave me a dad." Thank you so much.